Welcome to the Sober Buddy Podcast, your boost of sober thinking and awesome life building. I am Tara Zoe, CEO and co-founder here at Sober Buddy, and I am joined by my dad and co-founder Paul Brethen, marriage family therapist and expert in substance abuse addiction and treatment. Today, we're going to talk about triggers, what they look like, what they feel like, and how to handle them. I know you guys are interested in this. So let's get into it. Welcome to the show, Dad.
Hello, I'm back.
You're back.
This is good. I'm back.
We got you on. We have all these special guests, and now it's just like we need to get down to the nuts and bolts. Let's have Paul back on. So,
Welcome. Thank you.
Welcome. Yes. Okay, so let's talk about triggers because, I mean, this is a big thing. Like, when we're in recovery, what is the trigger? Like, let's just talk about, like, what is a trigger? You want to kind of talk about that first?
Yeah, a trigger, you know, the term's been used a lot, but I don't know if people understand the context of, like, its origins. What's it based in?
Yeah, let's talk and about the origins of a trigger.
Yeah, and it actually goes back 100 years.
Oh, wow, you know more than I thought you did. Okay, go for it. Didn't know you knew like the history of triggers.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's part of the cognitive behavioral therapy.
Okay,
you know?
Okay. And, it was like a word that came from cognitive behavioral therapy. Okay.
Well, yeah, it maybe developed later on, but the concept, you know, and it was actually Ivan Pavlov.
Oh, wow, you even know his name. I feel like so impressed by this right now. Okay, keep going.
It was called classical conditioning. And he was the one that developed this. And it's really, there's an interesting
story. Oh, because of Pavlov's dog.
Yes, yes.
Okay, I'm catching on.
Pavlov's dog. Yeah, yeah. So, but there's a story. I mean, I think I like to talk about this because it has a real impact on recovery. You know, we got the first classical conditioning of the dog. So, and the story was he kind of stumbled into this, this that we call classical conditioning. And so he was a physiologist studying the digestive system of a dog, measuring saliva. And his assistant would come in wearing a white lab coat, bringing the food to feed the dogs. And he realized that the saliva increased when she brought in the food. So all of a sudden he goes, like what's going on? So he starts researching this behavior because it was like an automatic physiological response, you know, like this.
Like the dog wasn't consciously thinking, oh, food. His body just responded.
Right. Okay. Right. It was just like, why did that happen? So I began to, you know, do these experiments and using other stimuli, like the ringing of a bell and, you know, and then the food. And so there's this pairing that occurs. This is where the trigger comes in, to where, you know, the food is a reward. So if you think about drugs and alcohol, especially certain drugs, the powerful reinforcers, huge stimulus. You know, so the idea of when you like the bell, he started using a bell. And so in the ringing of a buzzer or a bell, the dog would anticipate, right, this automatic like craving, anticipation for the food.
And he could be anywhere, hear that bell and think food, and his body would be like,
so
I'm about to eat.
Association with the sound or an image or the, you know, the assistant coming in with the white robe. And so there's all these cues or what they call like triggers that are when you see the stimulus, there's that association, you have this craving. So what is this, you know, like a dog's saliva.
Yeah.
And, you know, get excited, the tail would wag, you know, it's like, okay. So that's sort of the, you know, the foundation of this comes from. And now if you think about in recovery, it's the same thing that happens. You have these cues or these stimuli that trigger a automatic physiological response, which is like a craving that moves you towards or anticipation of the actual reward, which is the drug itself, like cocaine. So let me give you an example. You have somebody who gets paid on every Friday. And so Friday comes around and all of a sudden he's getting a little bit more anxious or excited. He can't wait till work's out. He gets the paycheck. He goes directly to the ATM machine, cashes it, right? Gets the money out. Okay? And then he gets in his car, drives to the neighborhood, where this dealer is, sees the house, you know, he comes, gets the drug, goes back in the car, goes to the park where he uses, pulls out the pipe, smokes it, and he's in the car. So all of a sudden you have all these stimuli, like this conditioning that's occurring.
Right, right.
Triggers. And that would be Fridays. See, it's like people,
so
places.
Friday would be a trigger.
Yeah. And then, of course, the paycheck. So you start having a little bit more excitement going. The ATM machine would be a trigger. Mm. Cash would be a trigger. Mm. Driving to the neighborhood. So the neighborhood would be a trigger.
Right.
The house, the dealer themselves, the drug itself, of course, the pipe, maybe got a special torch, the park. So all these things are associated with the reward of the drug itself.
Right. And so even if you're not going to be using the drug, if you encounter any of those situations, your body might be anticipating it, and it becomes massive craving then.
And it's an automatic. It's it's like unconscious. It happens. It's just that connection between the two.
So if you're out and about and you're in recovery, you're just going about your life, you know, you're not even thinking, and something happens, you know, a bell rings. Right? Like the dog.
Right.
All of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I need, like all of a sudden I have this intense craving for my drug of choice. Okay. So that's how a trigger happens. And
by the way, the cravings are so strong, you know, this idea of impulse control, you know, your rational part of your brain, it kind of gets moved to the side. Mm. It's like,
you have to go find it.
Yeah, it's like gets lost, it disappears, and you become impulsive, and you're not thinking anymore about, gee, I need to go home, or have an appointment, or I meet somebody, or you know what I'm saying? I got to pick up my kids. Mm-hmm.
Well, how long? So if you're triggered, you know, I've seen a lot of people, you know, this is a big conversation that we have. How long does a trigger last? Like, if I'm like, okay, I'm just going to ride out this trigger. How long does a trigger typically last?
Well, are you talking about once you're triggered? Or
like once you're triggered, like I have this kind of, let's call it an adrenaline rush or whatever it may be is the craving. Right. So I guess how long does the craving last? Not the trigger, because the trigger is just a point. But like how long can people expect that craving to last? Do you know?
Well, if you're in this, we call drift, if you're constantly being triggered, the craving, it just intensifies.
Right.
So I'm saying,
So you like, if you're, and that could be,
you could be exposed to triggers for several days. Mm. You know what I'm saying? If you want to, I mean, it's like, it's immediate, it's quick, that kind of scenario. Or, you know, if you're, and this gets into the recovery issue, you know, what do you do? Well, the obvious is to avoid the triggers.
Right. So that's your preventative. Possible. Your preventative is try to identify your triggers and avoid them.
Yeah. Identify them, what they are. And you also have emotional triggers. It's just not people, places, and things.
Right.
You know, if you're stressed out, if you're angry, if you're lonely, any kind of, even if you're happy and excited, you know, the party atmosphere.
Right. Right.
Can trigger you. So,
and so we have two challenges. Strategy. We have two challenges in the Sober Buddy app that we talk about that. Like, let's identify your physical triggers and then let's identify your emotional triggers, you know, just so that you can avoid them.
Yeah. Right. Actually, there's more than two. There's several that do. And then there's the other thing of the relapse justifications. You're getting triggered, so now you're having these thoughts that add to the whole scenario.
So now you're like talking into using.
Yeah, you're talking to yourself and you kind of go, well, you know, I think I'll check on my old friend. I haven't seen him in a long time. I want to make sure he's okay. Or I'm going to
try your to dealer. Get him off
and drug. Yeah, right. So there's a lot. That's the cognitive part. So you got the behavioral and then the cognitive. And
cognitive, just so if anybody doesn't know what that means, it just means your brain, like your thinking.
That's the relapse justification.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Your thinking.
You're thinking about
this stuff. And so once again, it's be smart, not strong. Mm-hmm. And some people go, well, I can handle this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a little humorous, but I was working with one client. And sometimes you'll challenge this quote, wisdom. You know, they have triggers. And so he figures, I'll buy some crack cocaine, keep it in the glove compartment of my car. And as long as I don't use that, I'm doing well in treatment.
So it was like testing his strength.
That's right. Testing his strength. It lasted about 2 days.
Because what the moral of that story is that I think this is powerful. You know, it overcomes. Assuming you're going to be able to separate the two. You're going to be able to say, well, like cognitively, logically, oh, well, I've decided not to use, but the way the brain works is those senses get flooded. Like you said, the rational part of your brain kind of gets put to the side and the craving takes over. And so that's why we have challenges like go remove all of the, you know, alcohol from your house or anything that reminds you of using in your house.
Right. Right.
Or car in this case.
And that's part of, I think that's the early phase. It's important. And by the way, it could be months, even longer, you know, and you think you're okay. And you put yourself in a situation that triggers you, say, and it could be just as though it was yesterday. Like, I mean, the power of that, the memory, and these memories are always there. You got to remember it's an experience. So you could have 10 years clean. You know, and whole array of certain triggers and exposure, you know, can trigger thoughts. And then if you meditate on the thoughts, you start having more cravings and then, you know, you're on a roll. So,
and I've heard multiple stories of people, even like they've been sober for a long time and then they have kids and the kids, because like their trauma was from their childhood or whatever, remind them and all of a sudden they're triggered and they get back into it. So it's like different life stages, different circumstances can bring you back into that trigger. And that's not to say to live in a fear space, like, oh my God, there's a trigger around the corner. It's just having tools in your toolbox. You know, if you have tools in your toolbox, then you say, okay, I'm triggered. You can acknowledge you're triggered. You're not just like, oh my God, what's happening? I'm having cravings from my trigger. And I have a plan with how to deal with that. So let's talk about that. How do we deal with a craving?
Well, let me kind of back up.
Okay,
a little bit.
Skipped over
There's
things.
The idea of
I'm oversimplifying.
Of extinction. extinction, which means that whole pairing process will eventually, you know, subside or disappear. It really can do that. And time between.
So there is hope. Right. There is hope over time that will dissipate.
Yeah. It's more of like you'll have less cravings. The cravings will subside and that whole pairing thing can change. In fact, let me kind of go into one more thing about Pavlov, his work. I think this is important to our topic.
Okay.
Is that there's work that he was doing that most people don't know about. And so let me tell you a little of the story. He's working with these animals and there was a storm and the lab flooded and the dogs were in these kennels, in these cages. And so it started filling up with water and the dogs were panicking, right? And
they can't get out of the cage. This is a really scary story.
Yeah.
I'm terrified right now.
Their nose is sticking to the top of the cage, right? The water. And they're in there for several hours, cold water, and the storm and lightning and trees are falling. And so finally they get in there. They rescue the dogs. They had to open up the cage and push the dogs underwater to get them out the door and then they had to swim out. Okay. These dogs are traumatized.
Yeah, for sure. You know. I'm a little traumatized just listening to the story.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Here's the interesting thing. So when they went back to doing their, you know, research and testing, all that conditioning ended. There was no
trauma
response.
Broke it.
Trauma broke it. Say.
Interesting.
And then he started looking at this.
Wait, I would just like to hold on. This does not mean, just for clarification, that we're recommending that you all go out and traumatize yourselves to break your addiction. I don't think that'll work.
Well, you know, I mean, it will.
But now you got a whole new set of problems. Okay. Yeah, the conditioning stopped working.
He started researching the idea of a breaking point. Of like stress, see, And now this gets really interesting. And I think this is really important. So he found out that there are certain dogs that are easier to break.
Oh, no. Did he test breaking dogs? I don't want to know. Well, let's just gloss over that.
Yeah. And but, however, now here's the thing. Those who had easier way to break were easier to recover. Those who are harder to break were harder to recover. Oh. Okay. Now, what was interesting is when he's working with these dogs are really hard, he could reverse. The only way he could start to reverse this breakdown was imposing stress. Now, this doesn't seem to make sense because stress is what, you know, kind of breaks. To reverse the breakdown, you know, this trauma, he had to impose stress. Now, small doses of stress that was well managed in an environment, you know, helped the dogs to kind of return back to their former selves. So the lesson here,
I'm like, how does this translate to like humans? Because right now it's not a happy story. Keep going. I'm not encouraged. I mean,
all right, let's do that. Let's talk about recovery.
Okay.
Now, recovery is stressful. It's not easy.
Oh, so like the struggle of recovery is actually what's bringing you back. What a beautiful story. I'm going to cry. Oh my gosh. That's so pretty and beautiful. Okay. So for all of you, I'm seriously tearing up. For all of you who are right now struggling in your recovery, that's what's bringing you back to yourself.
It does. It brings the healing.
Okay. I was sketch on this story. I was like, he's just bringing us into a really dark place.
Anyways, it brings you back to life quicker and sooner.
Wow. Now,
this is the cool thing. You ready for this?
Yeah.
There's one thing he discovered I thought was really amazing is that the one thing that worked better, faster, more reliable than anything else. Are you ready for this? Human connection.
Whoa. I'm shook right now. I feel like this is the best podcast we've ever had.
Think about this, and this is true, that let's talk about the dogs. The dogs, he realized that when the trainers or the people who are working with the dogs, when they stayed with the dogs, they recovered faster instead of leaving them alone. When they're alone and isolated, they get stuck. They don't recover.
So you gotta find community.
So the idea of being with people who are positive, who are supportive, you know, getting a hug, getting recognition, some empathy, you know, talking about, it's the human connection.
This is healing you. This is healing you.
That's right. That's right.
Whoa. Whoa.
Yeah.
This, honestly, I feel like we couldn't have written a better movie script for this podcast. I feel like this is like the best story arc podcast.
Isn't that amazing? Now, this was discovered back in 1904. I mean, you know, he was born in 1849 or something like that.
I have no idea. Yeah. Wow. Wow. You've just been sitting there with this knowledge this whole time.
I think that reinforces why, you know, one of the main things that recovery works is the, you know, being in the groups. And let me tell you another story. Okay. This is experience. When we started off at Matrix, we were doing individual counseling. We're therapists, and we knew that therapeutic rapport, like human connection, right, really is what works really good. And so we were doing this for several years. I would see clients at least three individual sessions a week, and then we had like an education group, right, for family members. We decided to flip it to do groups, three groups, and only a few individuals. And I'm thinking, oh, this won't work. I mean, I'm going to lose that connection. And they're going to, you know, not do as well. And we had all the data about, you know, how often they attended, how well they were doing, urine test results. We went to the groups and lo and behold, it worked better. It was more powerful. And you think about this, at the, you know, the group, the consensus of a group, if everybody is positive and moving towards, you know, the same journey, same direction, it's much more than an individual.
Right.
So, and that checked out with the data. You can't argue with the data, the outcome.
Right, right. People different. Stayed sober yeah. longer. Yeah.
Yeah.
That, you know, people, well, there you go. So the moral of the story is, we were talking about triggers, is that the way that you heal from triggers is through your struggle back in recovery mm-hmm. and your connection with others.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Now that... That's that. But then there's the detail of like, how do you manage the
triggers? Well, yeah. Cognitive. Yeah. We know that knowing how to handle triggers, because you have to get through them. Yeah. Right. And that's that right. Identifying your triggers, trying to not be triggered, and then knowing how to deal with it and having a plan for when you are triggered. Okay. So, right. Well, I have loved this podcast. This has been, guys, this is why we love having him at Sober Buddy. He's like, just drop these nuggets, even though you get mad at us for cussing, we get these nuggets from you. We're just let me tell you this really deep, profound story that you guys will all cry over. Okay, so that was fabulous. Well, I am excited, everyone, that we had this talk with my dad, with Paul, and we believe that you can have a better life than you've ever had before, and take it one moment, one struggle. Now, I might just start saying one struggle at a time, because now I'm feeling like the power of your struggle back, like that's actually what's healing you. I love that. So take it one struggle at a time, everybody. You have got this. You are healing.